May it please the court, Leah Ann Aiken for appellant wife Heidi Lynn Hagar, now known as Heidi Lynn Huntington. Husband has conceded that as a matter of the law, the lower court did err when it made its maintenance award non-modifiable, and wife does request that this court remand it to the lower court with specific instructions that it may be made modifiable. The trial court also erred as a matter of law because it failed to find that to the extent husband had performed future services for Microsoft by the time the decree was issued, the restricted stock units did contain a marital property portion. Thus, whenever the decree was issued, to the extent those future services had been performed, the restricted stock units should have been found to have contained a property component that should have been divided under the court's property division. And this particular argument is made giving deference to the court's finding that the restricted stock units were given completely for future services. The valuation of the...
Also, were they vested? The right to the stock award, was that vested?
According to the definition under the stock plan, at the time they were awarded, they were not vested. But under both N. Ray Marriage of Miller and N. Ray Marriage of Balanson, the definition of vesting under the stock plan is not determinative of whether or not those restricted stock units contain our property and contain a marital portion.
So I understand your argument, Ms. Aiken. There's some incremental portion of the stock options that, although it didn't vest under the strict definition of the case law, they were nevertheless subject to becoming marital property for that period of time between the hearing and the time the permanent order is actually issued. You don't know what those are, but
correct.
But whatever they are should be determined.
Yes.
Are we talking about something that is not particularly large?
Your Honor, we believe there is a significant portion within each grant that vests in the future that represents future services during the marriage that husband did perform for Microsoft. And if we look, for example, in Balanson,
we can't, based upon the record before us, we couldn't make that determination.
No, Your Honor, and what we would request is that this court remand the issue of recalculating the value of the marital portion within each of the grants as they vest, remand that to the lower court so that the property division can be amended, and because that property division is related to maintenance, the maintenance order under Powell must be remanded as well and reconsidered. The key here is that the court, in its holding, found that the restricted stock units were based on future services. Yet, to the extent that husband had performed those future services, each one of these grants, as they vest in the future, will contain a marital component. And it's our position that that is a significant marital component. To the fact that these stocks have not vested when they were granted is not determinant. Under both Miller and Balanson, whether or not something is vested might be relevant in tax contexts, but it's not determinative in whether or not it's property. Under Miller, what is determinative is whether services have been performed already at the time of the decree. So to the extent an employee stock option is granted in consideration of past services, that option may constitute marital when granted. The court here appears to have based its decision in part on the fact that husband had no enforceable contract rights in these restricted stock units. Husband actually did have enforceable contract rights in these restricted stock units. At Exhibit 21, the Microsoft stock plan, the 2001 version, and the individual stock award agreements state that Microsoft may not modify or amend or accelerate or defer the stock award without the consent of the awardee. As in contrast to Miller, husband does not have voting rights associated with these restricted stock units. He does not have the ability to collect the dividends that are associated with them because they're not stock awards, they're restricted stock units. Yet he does have enforceable rights in them, in that Microsoft cannot amend, accelerate, defer, or modify without his consent. Therefore, that raises these restricted stock units from the level of just being mere expectancies to the level of having a property component. In Balanson, the court actually found that in that particular case, dealing with stock options, particular stock options that vested 1 week after the permanent orders date and the decree was issued, those stocks that vested 1 week after were marital and contained marital property because they represented services that had been performed during the marriage. And it's important to note, though, that at the time the decree was issued, those stocks had not vested. And that was a significant amount of stock there. As I recall, it was 62,500 shares of stock options that were 1 week after the decree found to have been marital property. And here we have a situation where restricted stock units will be vesting over 4 year periods. And future services were performed after they were issued. Those future services were performed during the marriage. And the court's order completely overlooks the fact that some future services were performed during the marriage. Therefore, as the court did note, there is an incremental portion, obviously decreasing over time, that does represent property.
Well, I don't think I noted that. I think that what I said was that's your argument. But in fact, your argument runs a bit contrary to the language of the plan, since the plan says that the stock grants are voluntary and occasional and does not create any contractual or other right to receive future awards or benefits in lieu of stock awards, even if stock awards have been awarded repeatedly in the past. An agreement goes on to say all decisions with respect to future awards, if any, will be at the sole discretion of Microsoft. Am I misquoting the record?
No, Your Honor. But we would also like to stress that there is the additional language that Microsoft cannot modify, amend, accelerate, or defer the stock awards. So,
it can revoke them. Because in its discretion, it can come to the conclusion that no awards ought to be made. Isn't that right?
That is correct. The court also erred as a matter of law when it imputed income to wife without first finding that she was shirking her child support obligation. Because no finding was made that wife was intentionally foregoing higher paying employment, the order must be reversed. And this is a matter of reversible error because there are absolutely no findings in the court's record that wife was intentionally shirking her child support obligation. Under People v. Martinez, 70 P3D 474, 479, Colorado 2003, the court explicitly states that the legal standard for imputation of income involves a preliminary two-step process. First, the court must determine whether or not the parent is intentionally shirking a child support obligation. If such findings are made, then the court may go further and find that the individual is underemployed or intentionally unemployed. Only if the court finds that the individual is voluntarily unemployed or underemployed may income be imputed instead of using actual income. In this particular case, wife did have an actual income from 2010. That was $2,250 per month. Yet, the court determined that it was appropriate to impute income to her with making no finding that she was intentionally earning $2,250 and foreclosing on any other higher paying employment. The court also erred as a matter of law when it failed to determine whether any of the exceptions to underemployment under 1410.115.5b3 applied. Counsel argued at the trial that both A and C as exceptions applied. One, wife's employment choice was in good faith and it wasn't intended to deprive the children, and her choice is reasonably intended to result in higher income within the reasonable foreseeable future. Even if the court had made the appropriate findings that wife was underemployed and voluntarily unemployed, the court erred as a matter of law when it based its imputed income on wife's 2005 earnings. This was reversible error, as under In re Marriage of Upson and the child support statute, ordinary and necessary business expenses, reasonable business expenses, are to be deducted in determining a self-employed individual's income, and that was not done here. The court's factual findings as to imputation of income may be set aside if they are not supported by the record and are clearly erroneous under In re Marriage of Breaker, 952 PTD 783. The court's factual findings here were not supported by the record, and in determining first to use the 2005 gross income without deducting the reasonable and necessary business expenses, the court did commit reversible error. Finally, with respect to the maintenance order, the court wholly abused its discretion under 1410.114.2A-F. Here we had a 14-year marriage. There were two children. Wife was a stay-at-home mom. Wife had only worked on a consistent full-time basis in 2005, 6 years ago, at the time of permanent orders. She'd only worked full-time for a period of 15 to 16 months. The court awarded $3,000 a month for 2 years. In this particular case, husband's income was $16,370 per month, and that did not even include his in-kind income, which was an additional $5,973 per month. Thus, the court's maintenance award does not reflect a consideration or an accurate consideration of the factors under 1410.114. The court wholly abused its discretion, and in doing so, the court created a great inequity between the two parties, and I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Tucker Katz, attorney registration number 36886, and I represent the appellee, Jason Hager, with no disrespect to either party, and for clarity, I will try to address the appellee as Mr. Hager or husband, and the appellant as Ms. Hager or wife. There are four issues currently pending before this court. One requires this court to resolve a matter of law. A matter of law which we have conceded is that the maintenance award entered by this trial court has to be modifiable. I'll submit to the court, and it is part of the record, that we did attempt to correct that legal error with the wife after the trial. That was unsuccessful. We filed our own Rule 59 motion asking the trial court and citing In re the Marriage of Lee, saying, Your Honor, this needs to be modifiable, and that was denied. We think the court can, as a matter of law, adjust that and say that the maintenance award that was entered by the court was modifiable. The three other issues that we're here to address shall all be resolved under the clearly erroneous standard. Specifically, the court has to address whether the trial court abused its discretion in finding that the wife was voluntarily underemployed and imputing her income at a rate of $5,000 a month.
No, we didn't make any findings about her being underemployed, did he?
Well, I would disagree, Your Honor, respectfully. The court's order with respect to imputation of income found that it was unreasonable for wife to earn the amount of money that she was claiming she earned at the time of trial. The court's order specifically states that it is reasonable for the wife to earn $5,000 a month based on her prior earnings, education, and prior earnings. And I think implicit in that order from the court is that if it's reasonable for her to earn $5,000 given her prior earnings, education, and work experience, that it's unreasonable for her to only earn $2,250. And I think there's ample record support for that finding by the judge, that $2,250 per month was an unreasonable salary. Those factors include, first let me just address, there's nothing in CRS 1410.115.5b, the imputation statute, or the case law, including In re Martinez, that says the court needs to find that a person is intentionally shirking. What it says is the intent of the income imputation provision is to impute income when a parent shirks his or her child support obligation by unreasonably foregoing higher pay that he or she could obtain. And that's what the court found here, that she was unreasonably, that it was unreasonable for her to only earn $2,250. And I think the facts in the record that support that are numerous. There's her education. The court cited to three factors specifically: her prior earning capacity, education, and experience. Those are all relevant factors pursuant to In re the Marriage of Martinez to determine whether or not a person is voluntarily underemployed and to determine how much income to impute to them.
That's, as I understand it, the argument was made that there were exceptions. And the trial court does not appear to have addressed the exceptions specifically, correct?
They don't specifically, but I think if you read the paragraph on the child support imputation or the whole maintenance award, it does address them. One is that this was a good faith career choice that is not intended to deprive child support and does not unreasonably reduce the support. And the court found that it did implicitly unreasonably reduce the support because she was only saying that she was producing $2,250 of income. And so what the court said is, look, it's reasonable for you to earn $5,000 a month. A reasonable and necessary conclusion from that is she was unreasonably denying support for the child by only earning $2,250 per month. I think the exceptions were both addressed. There was some mention that wife was somehow mentally or physically incapacitated and could not work. The judge clearly addressed that issue. The judge stated that she was an active, healthy woman and that she had no physical or mental disability that prevented her from working as an accountant or a financial analyst. So I think the court did address those issues. Just quickly on the imputation of income and the facts in the record that supported the court's finding was that Ms. Hager had an accounting degree from the University of Puget Sound that she earned in 1996. This is the same degree that Mr. Hager has, that she graduated near the top 10% of her class, that directly out of college she was able to earn between $24,000 and $26,000 a year. That is almost the exact same income she was claiming 15 years later, despite the fact that over that 15-year period, she had been constantly employed as an accountant and financial analyst. The evidence was that her resume was the best evidence of how much she worked, and if the court looks at that, she had comprehensive work experience doing detailed and complicated financial analysis. She wasn't a mere bookkeeper, as they tried to argue during permanent orders. The evidence that also supports the finding that she was underemployed was the fact in 2005, 6 years prior to permanent orders, she was earning a base salary of $50,000 a year, which is $4,167 per month. The court imputed a mere $800 more a month to her than she was earning in 2005. And between 2005 and 2011, the time of permanent orders, she continued to work, continued to develop skills and increase her ability to charge clients and generate revenue. Also supporting that was in 2005, she also had $64,000 of gross business revenue. And there was no testimony from her telling the court how much of that should be reduced by ordinary and necessary business expenses. And so the court was free to say she generated in 2005 $80,000 she was able to earn. Some of that might have been reduced by expenses, but there was no testimony to how much of it was. And that is clearly something the court could rely on and determine that it was unreasonable for her to only earn $2,250 per month. And lastly, there was testimony that in December of 2011, 4 months before permanent orders, wife was offered a job to go work for a company, VCFO, with a base salary of $100,000 a year. There was testimony from Mr. Hager to that effect. There was an email from Ms. Hager admitting that she had that job offer. And the case law is clear that if a person declines an offer for employment at a much higher rate, then the court can impute income to that person, and I think that's exactly what the court did here. I'd like to move on to the stock awards question, unless the court has any other questions about the imputation of income analysis. With respect to stock awards, Colorado law is clear that an employee stock option or stock award constitutes property for the purpose of a dissolution of marriage proceeding only when the employee has an enforceable contract right. That's from In Re the Marriage of Miller and In Re Balancin. The Miller court held that an employee does not have an enforceable right to a stock option granted in consideration for future services until those services have been performed. And the seminal case is Balancin. The issue in that case is whether at the time of permanent orders, husband had performed the requisite service under his option contracts to entitle him to any of the options that his employer granted him.
As I understand Ms. Egan's argument, and perhaps I'm missing it, but what I understood her to say is that from the time of the hearing to the time that permanent orders were issued, there were future services rendered, and that for those future services, there was some incremental portion of the stock awards that were not vested but should be computed as marital property. And I guess my question is, in any lawsuit, in any hearing, from the time that you have the hearing and you put on your evidence to the time that the order is issued by the trial court, if there is new evidence that comes to mind, isn't that a Rule 60B motion?
It is, Your Honor. And, you know, our whole position is if you look at Balancin, the parties were married 26 years. In October of 1996, husband's employer granted him 300,000 shares. 62,500 were going to vest 1 year later in October 1997. I might have misstated that. They granted him in 1996. 62,500 were going to invest in October 1997. It was undisputed that those shares, all 300,000 of them, were issued for future performance. the $62,500 vested in October 1997. The decree was entered in October 1997. The court held specifically that because at the time of permanent orders, husband had only completed employment required to enforce his rights to exercise the 62,500 shares, those were marital, and the rest were not property, were a mere expectancy. And that's exactly the same question here is, what enforceable contract rights did husband have to any of the options on April 15th, 2011? And the answer is none. And the answer is none for a variety of reasons. One is because the employer, in their sole discretion, with or without cause, could terminate him, and that would cause a complete forfeiture. Beyond that, the stock, every stock agreement in itself, in bold language, says that changes to his employment status, meaning leaves of absence, or change in the number of hours he works, or change in the position that he has, will and can affect not only the vesting, but also the termination, that the awards could go away, and how those changes in his employment status affected his rights to those awards is based on the company's sole discretion. And I think, Your Honor, you were correct that the stock award agreements themselves set forward other conditions and limitations. And the clear fact is, sitting in court on April 15th, 2011, there's nothing Mr. Hager could have done to enforce those contract rights, to get his company to turn them over to him. And that's a big difference between this case and In Re the Marriage of Miller, where In Re the Marriage of Miller, the husband had restricted stock units. They were granted, the court found that actually the husband in that case actually owned the shares because he received dividends and voting rights and all the incidents of ownership. That wasn't the case here. But more than that, in Miller, the court, the stock grants to the husband in that case entitled husband to a portion of those shares, even if he was terminated during the restriction period. So it's easier to say that someone in Miller's case, if he's completed 6 months of a year restriction period, and the stock agreement says if you're terminated before the end of that year, you get a portion of your awards, it's much easier to see why the Miller court found that to be a property, whereas here, his contracts don't say that. If he doesn't work until, I think it's August 30th of every year, nothing vests, he has no contract right, and he cannot do anything to enforce those. I think it's been agreed that the trial court, in this case, specifically found that the awards were granted in consideration for future services. I think that factual finding has ample support in the record, supported by the testimony of Fred Studer, who was Mr. Hager's direct supervisor, who said 100% of these stock awards are granted for future performance. He said, none of these were granted to induce him to come to Microsoft for work that he's already done as a bonus. He said, we have three forms of compensation at Microsoft: stock awards, bonus, and pay. And he said, bonus and pay are granted in consideration of past and present services, whereas stock awards are 100% granted for future performance. The awards themselves and how they were given to Mr. Hager also supports the court's finding that they were granted for future performance. The company had discretion to grant them outright, to grant him fully vested stock awards. They did not do that. They granted him unvested stock awards that vest 20% each year for 5 years. I think it's clear, my time is winding down, that their argument for some incremental portion of these stock awards is clearly not supported by Balancing. In Balancing, if they had thought that husband's service of 1 year was sufficient to grant wife some entitlement to the additional shares, they would have done that, but they didn't. They said, at the time of trial, husband had performed 1 year of service. That entitled him to 62,500 shares, and that's it. Wife doesn't have any claim to the two 137,500 shares that we're going to vest in the subsequent years, because those were based on performance that had not been done. It's a simple contract principle. He had not performed the requisite employment in order to have an enforceable contract, right? I'm just going to quickly, in the 4 seconds I have, the court did address every factor in 1410.114 subpart 4 with respect to maintenance. It's detailed in the court's permanent orders. We don't think it's reversible error. Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honor, I just have one clarification that I'd like to make. With respect to the RSUs, from the time of the actual grant of the restricted stock units to the issuance of the decree of the dissolution of marriage, has been performed future services for Microsoft. And to the extent that he had performed those services, each restricted stock unit does contain a significant marital portion. It's not just from the time of the hearing to the time of the decree, but from the time of the grant to the time of the permanent orders during which future services were performed.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. This case will stand submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course.